You're listening to 88.7 WLUW, Chicago Sound Alliance, broadcasting live from the campus of Loyola University. And today on the show, we have a very special show. Hello, Mr. Ilan Grappelli, are you there?
I am here.
Hello.
Hello. Welcome to Chicago from New York for now.
And thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you for having me.
And, of course, in the studio as well, we have from Inon Israel Netti.
Hi.
Yes, my former roommate and neighbor.
Right. How are you?
Good. I feel like just yesterday I've seen you. Maybe it was a few days ago.
Okay. Are you ready for questions?
Are you asking them?
No, we're both going
okay.
to.
So, of course, I want to bring it back to 2011.
Sure.
And, I mean, before we get into your story and everything, the unbelievable things that happened, of course, what that was going on in Egypt was very important in terms of the geopolitical situation. So it was right after Mubarak fell that you went there?
It was a few months. He fell on January 25th, 2011, and I went in May. And by this, that was already about five months afterwards, where the situation somewhat stabilized. It was a little bit more stable than it was in the first month after, where there were riots and where there was upheaval every day. But by May, I was there for a month, and I was able to walk the streets, perform. I was able to do my job. I was able to go to the restaurants, and I didn't actually see much. There was not much. There wasn't all the action that I've seen that we saw in the news, for example, in January and February, where there was a lot more violence on the streets.
So you were in law school during that time?
Correct.
And so you decided, tell us about the process of deciding to go to Egypt and what was the mission over there, and everything surrounding that.
As you may know, since I think you're also a lawyer, that the employment situation, obviously lawyers can't be picky. If we get a job, we have to take it. Based on my past experiences, I had experiences in the Middle East. I also was an Arabic speaker with an interest in refugees and refugee rights and asylum seeker rights. So I found a job there that worked, that was at a church that cater to refugees. Cairo has a few hundred thousand refugees who come to Cairo, since it's the center of the Arab world, and it has many international organizations that provide various versions of assistance. And some of the refugees will come to Cairo with the hope of applying for asylum throughout the world, in Europe or in the United States. And then before they do that, they have to go through a variety of agencies and a variety of protocols, fill out a variety of forms, which are difficult, obviously, given the language barriers and also the legal barriers. So that was my job for the most part. I had a fellowship from my school to go there to interview them, write out briefs on their behalf, advocate on their behalf, and then the United Nations would decide after eventually the goal was to go to the United Nations. The briefs would reach the United Nations, and then the United Nations would decide whether or not there's a place to resettle them, or sometimes the United States also took on a number of, or a few thousand refugees, probably spent more a year if they met the criteria. So that was my job, and I did actually start doing that for at least the first, I was there for a month before everything happened, so I was able to work in that field, which has always been an interest, so it pretty much was a good nexus of all my interests of law, immigration, and asylum rights, and that world.
So you were in Egypt seeing and trying to interview and help the Egyptian Christians become refugees and gain asylum rights.
But it wasn't usually Christians. It was usually, because Egyptian Christians wouldn't necessarily be refugees. It was more the Sudanese. So the Sudanese who came from there, since it's an adjacent country, most of them came. There are a good maybe 100,000 Sudanese refugees who were living in Cairo. And also there were a lot of Iraqi refugees from the Iraqi war, and they had a form of, they have a, There's a few special clauses where Iraqis, if they could somehow prove that they worked with the United States government during the war, they might have priority in their application, their refugee applications. So they were a substantial portion of the refugees who were applying for resettlement within the United States. So it's usually helping either the Sudanese or the Iraqis who are there in the country.
And you are a dual national, isn't that correct?
Yes.
And you have both Israeli and U.S. citizenship.
Yes.
So going over there, was it, I mean, even before everything that happened, was it nerve-wracking? What were you thinking at the time?
This time was already probably my sixth or seventh time. I used to go there from Israel and a number of times for study. And then when I started to learn the country and I started to learn where it was safe to go and where it was less safe to go, I felt comfortable. And I would be usually in Cairo, so I was able to tell which people I was able to tell, who I was not able to tell. I was studying, so I allowed a lot of friends from the students and also my teachers who also introduced me to the population. I think when I used to go, from what I understand, before the revolution, when I used to go, it was a security state, so there was a lot of undercover security officers from the various security apparatus in the country, so they were probably always keeping me under their eye, both for security, both for purposes of security, to make sure there was no international incident against me, and also to make sure that I wasn't doing anything suspicious in their eyes. So, I mean, I knew the culture, the security culture that was there, and I knew that I knew that there could always be some random people who go crazy, who want to take vengeance on me as an Israeli. So I would make sure, I would never obviously go into areas which were outside of the city, or areas where I made myself vulnerable within the city, or if I was in the middle of Cairo, it would be more difficult for anybody to do anything next to the variety of police stations and army patrols that were always around. I knew my way around the streets by that time.
Let me remind our listeners, you're listening to 88.7 WLUW, Chicago Sound Alliance, the Logic Consortium, with our interview with Ilan Grappel. And we're tweeting live at WLUW, if you have any questions for Mr. Grappel, about the big situation that he went through in 2011 in Egypt. He's a dual U.S.-Israeli citizen. And we're getting into the unbelievable situation, experience, and that he went through. So you're going over there to help interview refugee Christians coming up from the Sudan and coming in from Iraq. And you'd been there many times before to Cairo. And you speak Arabic very well. Isn't that correct?
Right, so that's it wasn't only Christians, it was Christians, if it were, sometimes it was Shia Muslims, sometimes it was Sunni Muslims, depending on who was persecuting whom. So there was a variety of minorities who were trying to apply for, based on a variety of pretexts. And I spoke Arabic also from study, and then I lived in the country a few times before that, and also I learned in Israel a few times. So the language helped, so if I didn't necessarily want to reveal my whole background, I could usually speak circumspectly about that I'm from the region, and hence I speak Arabic, and that usually was able to quell any possible or any more questions. I could usually get around the questions they speak in Arabic and interesting them through my language. Usually, I would say I'm from the region of Syria, which includes Israel, and then they would convince them that I'm from the area, and they wouldn't ask any more questions. A lot of them have a vacuum in their vacuum, and they don't even consider the fact that I might be from the country which is south of Syria, which is Israel. So I had a lot of techniques to avoid being completely outright if I felt I was not in my interest or if it was not safe for me to do so.
So before everything that happened, you did have... did I read you that there was a run-in with a fellow citizen or a fellow person from Cairo where you had to make a police report?
Oh, yeah, you did your research. Yeah, that was, that was probably, I think that usually doesn't even comes up in my interviews, but that was a few weeks before where it was just another person on the street who, you know where he's from, and then not necessarily out of any he probably had some anti-Israel sentiment anyway, but then his main interest was to get another daughter, to get another Egyptian daughter, which is Ghanae, and he tried to basically rip me off, and they realized that also in Egypt that the tourist is always right, so I took advantage of the situation. When we got a little tiff over a charge, and then I reported him eventually, and that caused them to be quite fearful, and I got my money back. As a result of that actually probably helped me later on. Well, I mean, when we go into that part of the story later on, it actually helped me because of the fact that I was very outright to the authorities when I needed to be. It was kind of a credit in my favor, showing that I wasn't actually hiding anything. So actually, I was able to use that to my advantage later on.
So shortly thereafter, tell us about the night of the arrest.
So it was actually the morning. It was probably a Sunday morning, and then probably about 6 to 7 a.m., and I was still, as any normal person would be, still in bed, but I was in a hostel. And then I heard the knock on the door, and then it was kind of fuzzy. It was still in my, I felt I was half dreaming when it happened. And then I was wondering who could be knocking at my door at 6 a.m., and then I discovered that it was 40 Secret Service officers in plain clothes and their mustaches and their guns, and then asking me to please get dressed and asking me to identify myself. That's pretty much where it started. Obviously, there's no Fourth Amendment rights that we have in the United States, but I knew I was in trouble without being completely informed of my rights or the charges against me. And that's how it started, pretty much.
So up until that time, you were teaching Hebrew as well, too?
I had a number of friends, so I was, as a broke law student, I didn't necessarily want to pay for Arabic lessons, so I was able to do language exchanges, which I guess many expats do, and there is an interest. There's actually a few thousand Hebrews, there's a few thousand Hebrew students in Egypt, and I was able to, some of my friends from my past trips, I was able to study and teach with them, and I would teach them an hour, they would teach me back an hour, or a few hours, so that was usually my exchange with them before, and that was before everything happened. I'm not sure what happened to those friends after the fact, given that anybody who was associated with me was probably interrogated themselves, and they had less, and they might have been also placed at risk or charged or threatened after the fact.
So when you first saw all these huge number of officials, did you think it had to do with that police report that you filed, or what was going on in your head at the time?
I had a feeling that it could be, it was obviously Israel related. I kind of tried to bring up the police report as a method, as a comic relief during a very tense situation. And, the officers, scoffed and said, oh, of course it's the police report. And then they said, well, we're just going to go and fill out some more forms relating to the police report. Which is why I asked, well, why do I need the handcuffs if I'm just filling out police reports? And they said, no, it's just protocol. And then I said, "Well, why do we need the blindfold if it's just protocol?" And they said, "No, it's all a normal procedure. Don't worry about it." So I mean, I kind of knew it wasn't related to that, but I tried to use it. It was actually my technique throughout to try to forge a connection, a human connection, which was very important throughout the 4 months or 5 months.
So they said, come with us, it's protocol. They didn't explain
No, they didn't explain anything. They said, oh, don't worry, it's perfectly natural. It's just this procedure. And then they put on the handcuffs, they put on the blindfold, and then they put me in the unmarked van. And then it gets obviously scary because nobody wants to be put in an unmarked van anywhere in the world, especially not in the Arab world. And then that's how it started, and then there was complete silence. The people that were accompanying me were no longer accompanying me. And then I was just, I guess what I would consider probably the more low-level police officers were surrounding me there and just told me not to speak or shut up. Then we had an hour ride. And then we arrived unblindfolded. Then I was unblindfolded, and I found myself as the prosecutor of Egyptian state security.
And I read somewhere that you told him, he said you needed a translator, and then you said you're learning Arabic, and he didn't smile and said you were crazy.
No, he actually did smile. So I mean, that was also part of my, it was just another way to build a rapport with everybody around me. I felt better to humanize myself rather than not. And then also I was trying to make light of the situation at the beginning and throughout the whole time. And before, like, he started talking about the actual charges and what would come after, we were just having a conversation for probably a good 6 to 7 hours, and we already had lunch. And then he brought up the idea of the Arabic teacher. And through this whole time, I don't know if any of our listeners have had language classes, but to have one-on-one language classes with obviously a very highly educated lawyer as a teacher, and the person that was writing out everything I said and correcting my grammar and putting it all on paper so I could see if I made any error in the phrasing of anything I said. I just pointed out that these kinds of things, especially in Israel where people pay a lot of money for Arabic lessons, I said that this would be, I said, if you ever wanted a new profession, you can make a lot of money in the profession. And he said, oh, maybe you'll consider it as a second summer job. But then he said, but I recommend that you have an actual translator due to the gravity of the situation. And I asked, well, why is the situation so grave? That's when he rolled out the charges, which were obviously very grave.
Okay, so before he rolled out the charges, you guys sat there for 6 to 7 hours, had lunch together, and you were kind of just talking? Is that was kind of the... What happened immediately when you arrived?
Smoking cigarettes, asking my name, what I'm doing in Egypt, what I study about American law, constitutional law, philosophy, my religious faith, my level of religious, my practice, my friends, my interests in life, what movies I liked. So I mean, there was a lot of conversation to go through, and I remember later on throughout this ordeal, I think I even asked him, I said, oh, we'll probably have a good conversation if, under normal circumstances, if I was not actually being threatened with multiple life imprisonments. But for the first few hours that I wasn't actually threatened, the conversation was flowing pretty good.
So then he rolls out the charges.
Yes.
And take us through that.
Then he wrote out the charges, and I mean, which was everything. I mean, but everything obviously came within the umbrella charge of espionage. And then I said, "What is that supposed to mean?" And he's like, "Well, it could be from 3 years," which I thought was last night. But that was a lot. And then he goes through the multiple life sentences when you add up every sub charge that I did, from seducing people to importing weaponry, what came out later in the interrogations, importing weaponry, inciting violence, insulting Obama, insulting President Obama, which was 3 years in itself. So add it all up, and it already was above the multiple life sentence, above the one life sentence.
Insulting President Obama?
Yeah, well, there's like one of, for whatever reason, one of the more media desirable pictures was a picture of me holding a sign that insulted President Obama. And for whatever reason, the newspapers liked that as the cover picture for me, from any article related to me. I never actually made the sign. I held it when I was waiting for public transportation. But for whatever reason, they took it to be one of my tactics to incite the people against the United States. And also, apparently, there's an Egyptian law where you're not allowed to insult any head of state, whether of Egypt or of any other country. And that carries a penalty of up to 3 years. So that was on the charge list. And I apologize to him after. I mean, I apologize. I never actually got to have a phone call with him, but I did apologize to him in one of the interviews.
To the president?
Yeah. I mean,
what did the sign say?
It was in relation to, at the time, I think he made a comment that the people were revolting because of the poverty and the hunger that they were all feeling, and that people, for whatever reason, got angry and saying, this is not a revolution of pride. This is not a revolution of hunger. This is a revolution of pride. And it said, oh, stupid Obama. It called him stupid. This is not a revolution of hunger. This is a revolution of pride. So I thought it'd be a good, somebody offered me to hold a sign and take a picture, which I did. It was on my laptop. I thought I'd like taking pictures of signs or like comical pictures, whether or not I actually agree with the statement. In this case, I didn't. But in another case, they had that picture, which they used to convey to the rest of the world media. That was a sign. That was like my least of my worries at the time.
Let me remind our listeners, you're listening to the Logic Consortium here on 88.7 WLUW Chicago Sound Alliance in our interview with Ilan Grappel, who in 2011 was doing refugee work in Cairo, Egypt, and is telling us about how he was detained by the authorities, and he's at the point where he was at the initial investigation speaking to with the Egyptian prosecutor, and the charges were just laid out that he was being accused of espionage, and he's just telling us how insulting President Obama was. It carried 3 years in itself to insult any head of state whatsoever. So, Mr. Grappel, can you... And we're tweeting live at WLUW for our Twitter handle. So if you have any questions for Mr. Grappel. So, Ilan, take us through what happened next.
There were interrogations for about 2.5 weeks. After the interrogations, I thought I might get out after 2.5 weeks, but... then they actually extended. I thought that after 2.5 weeks, I thought maybe the United States and the various government pressure that I understood was being placed on the Egyptian government to release me. I saw that might be enough to get me out very quickly. I mean, I assumed that the longer everything goes on, the more difficult my situation was. And when I got the first extension of my time, I felt that was
so. The longer,
after
it went on, the more difficult the situation became.
Exactly. I felt that then if they didn't release...
Hello, Ivan, are you there?
Yeah, hello? You all right? Oh, hello?
We're going to go to quick music interlude, and we'll be back in 1 second with our continuing our interview with Ilan Grappel.
Hello?
A beat up tank of oxygen on Mars. A drummer man for a metal band named Lars. A tracking device when eating.
Hello, Ilan. Are you there?
Yep, I'm here.
Hey, sorry about that. I had a little malfunction. So, please continue.
So once I got the extension, then I realized that if they're willing to extend my time, that means they're not regretting what they've already done. I thought they may regret their initial decision to arrest me. And if anything, now they're going in the other direction. They're trying to pile everything on me. They're trying to make me look to be pretty much James Bond Jr. with various schemes that purportedly I did. So they were just going in the opposite direction. They were not regretting, rather they were trying to just stick with their story as much as possible. So I thought that was a bad situation, which was a bad situation at the time. So I had this 2 weeks of interrogations, and I had this time extension. And then the interrogations pretty much stopped, and then I think they were deciding what are they going to do with the situation. I assume there that the Egyptians realize that they're in a bit of a jam, and on the one hand, they're presenting a story, and they can't actually say that they made a mistake, but also the Americans were feeling a lot of pressure putting a lot of pressure to release me, and there was a lot of political support on my behalf. And in the meanwhile, I was in solitary confinement, and I didn't know what was going on for the most part. So that was a situation that there was probably a lot of behind-the-scenes pressure between various governments, and I was pretty much in the black scene and sitting in my room wherever they kept me. So I didn't know what was going on while the various governments were trying to figure out a way out of the mess.
So that was... How far into the detention are we talking?
This is 2 weeks. So the first 2 weeks were, quasi-bearable in that I was taken out every day. I had my quote-unquote Arabic lessons for 8 hours a day where I was talking with the prosecutor about a variety of topics. Some innocuous, some questions I knew or some topics I knew. I was searching for some sort of incriminating evidence against me. So, but I was very careful for the most part about what I said, and I knew he was trying to get at if he was trying to incriminate me in anything. So it's about the first 2 weeks before I had my time extended. And then I had my time extended, unfortunately, after the first 2 weeks, mainly based on them reading Gmails. That was the impetus for them extending. That was the reason they gave me first, as in the time, or that was... they use that as, I'm sure they would have done it anyway, but it was easy for them to use the Gmails as a reason to further investigations.
What do you mean? Gmails?
For the first 2 weeks, they really had nothing. They were trying very hard to find something, and then in the last few days, they were going through my computer, and they were probably typing in random... random words that they thought were being of interest, like spy and pretty much things that one of the more ridiculous words that you could think of for a spy to have in his computer. But as most people would have, if you have spoken with your friends over the last 10 years, at least one, most people have probably kept the word spy in a variety of contexts, especially if you're a lawyer or an academic who has considered working with... was considered doing research or was interested in research and has read various websites, they saw that I was researching a topic from 10 years ago, and unbeknownst to them, they don't understand the concept of chatting and internet chat, so they just saw these code words which were highlighted red, and I thought that was expressing my interest to join various intelligence agencies around the world in particular. But the only one that they actually cared about was the Israeli intelligence agencies, and that was the one that I was considered to be working for. So once they see that these what they considered secretive G-chats, which were all on the computer, then they said that this was the evidence they needed. With this evidence, they would go to court and go to trial, and then that would be enough to lock me up and throw away the key, so to speak.
And so they showed. You the G-chats, and they use the G-chats as the evidence to continue the detention after the 2 weeks.
That was one of their evidence. They pretty much printed out everything on my computer. They had binders from the floor to the ceiling. I didn't even know at first. I didn't know what was in it. I was very curious to know. And then he pulled out these my chats from 8 years prior with half translations into Arabic because they were in English. Then there was other translations I was speaking. Then he had there were my chats to Israelis, and that was translated back into English and back into Arabic as well. So they had all these various chats, my Facebook chats, my Gmails, my emails from the last 10 years. And I'm pretty sure if you were to check anybody's emails and Facebook chats for the last 10 years, you could find something incriminating about them about some topic in the world. So that's what they did. And then after that, that was quite scary because I knew how they would probably interpret it, and not to my advantage. And then they sent me away, and then the interrogation stopped. And then I was pretty much alone in my room for 12 days, living pretty much living within my own thoughts. And then I didn't have much information because I only was able to talk to outside world maybe once every 2 weeks, and I was taken to the prosecutor's office. So I had no real information about what was going on. So I could only wonder and think the worst.
Let me remind our listeners, you're listening to 88.7 WLUW, Chicago Sound Alliance, broadcasting live from the campus Loyola University. and the program is the Logic Consortium, interviewing Ilan Grappel, who's telling us about the unbelievable situation that he experienced in 2011, going to Cairo, Egypt, helping refugees in Cairo make their way somewhere else in the world, refugees that came from Egypt and the Sudan and other places. And when he was doing the helpful public interest work there, he was detained by the Egyptian authorities, taken into custody, laid out charges of espionage. They found some Gmails of his in the past that they used to extend his period of detention, and then he's talking about his continued detention from that time on. So, Ilan, in those Gmails, you had expressed a desire maybe to work for an intelligence agency one day?
No, I mean, it was more like, what are we going to do? What kind of research jobs can we get? I could do research. Fulbright, I mean, even Fulbright was, I mean, they associated everything, they associated a variety of organizations with spy agencies. I was considered in Fulbright, which incorporated research. So that was a part of some sort of universal international agency of subversive political intent. So I mean, they attributed that to my espionage aspirations. Anything, pretty much any research job or any interest in also journalism. I wrote some journalistic papers for an agency in Australia. That was a part of the spy game. So I mean, they were able to take a variety of incidents in my life and just attribute it to espionage and research.
So then they continued to detain you, and tell us about the conditions of your detention.
I mean, the conditions physically were probably better than most people would have in prison in the world, in that I was probably put in the VIP of Egyptian prisons. I assume that's where they keep their, maybe their current or their former prime minister, maybe he's even kept there now. And then that I had a bed. I was in general population. I had a barred window, albeit in my own bathroom. So I mean, the conditions are relatively good, but that was not what I was looking for. When you're alone for long periods of time, when you actually needed social contact, but no one was allowed to speak to me. Probably for my own good, but for my own mental benefit. People do need to speak. And have social interaction. And I mean, that was the most difficult part, that I was kept alone. No one was really allowed to speak to me. There was a guard outside who would man the door, but he was also not ranked highly enough to speak with me or to have any interaction other than that if I need something to eat or if I need a drink. Only if the higher up officers would come, then I was allowed to talk to them. But that was also because they were hoping that I would give them some sort of valuable information, and if they thought that I was unwilling to cooperate, and then they would get bored very quickly and also end the conversation, and then I would go back to my room for another unknown period of time. So that was mainly mental was the greatest issue, that I had no information and I was cut off from the world.
Ilan, what did you do to pass the time?
What did I do to pass the time? Thank you, Nettie. A variety of things. Thankfully, I mean, the lifestyle was were books. I mean, some of the embassies, the American embassy and the Israeli embassy, sent me a variety of books, not the best ones, because whatever they had in the library was sometimes inappropriate for a jail time read. But eventually my parents ended up sending me some books, which I usually had one or two books a week, so that's obviously not enough. So I had to budget my time reading. I could only read maybe 100 pages a day, which is only a few hours, and when you have 12 hours of awake time a day, then there's only so much you could read. So I usually tried to sleep as much as possible, because that was the best way to avoid the situation. So I would maybe be able to sleep 12 hours a day on a good day. I would extend my meals for an hour or two, and then exercise. I would do exercise every day, so I got very good at push-ups. And then also I started to do, thankfully somebody sent me a yoga and meditation book, so that became critical. So I started doing yoga and meditation. I would do that every day for 2 hours, which is a great way to pass the time, and it also makes you better mentally. In general, I'd also play a lot of memory games. I would write out numbers and try to memorize them to make sure I could actually so I could employ my mind in some ways. I felt like my mind was shriveling based on the lack of any sort of interaction. So I thought that was some way that I could incorporate mind games and memory. Eventually, I started getting some test books so I could do solve like various math problems. The books were pretty much the most important instrument to pass the time.
And you were there during Ramadan.
And I was there during Ramadan, Ramadan was in August of that year, exactly.
And tell us, I read somewhere that you, to gain camaraderie with the guards, you definitely stuck to the rules, or?
I probably once in a while I sometimes saved somebody dessert and then ate it in the bathroom because there were cameras in the room, so I didn't want to eat in front of them. Because also, so I ate usually in the bathroom when they weren't looking once in a while just to also pass the time. But I also managed to sleep I used to sleep until noon, and then the sun would come down like maybe 8 more hours. So I would try to sleep through noon, and I would sleep again maybe a few hours later. And then we would get the breakfast, or we would get the last meal around 2 a.m. So I pretty much altered my schedule, and I tried to show them that I was trying to be a good boy, that I was trying to maintain or to follow their traditions. Also because many of them obviously were never exposed to people of other faiths or other cultures and other norms. So for them, it's almost taken as a given. I mean, a lot of them didn't even find it strange that I was fasting with them. They thought it was a given that we would all be fasting in Ramadan. So I just went with the flow.
And what about the food?
The food is also a part of the probably more positive conditions, also because I lost a lot of weight due to the nerves and due to the tension. So I could have my own variety of either Egyptian pizza or rice and lentils, or what else do they have? Rice and lentils, like yogurt and eggs. I'm a vegetarian. I was a vegetarian shortly before I was incarcerated, but I read actually an animal rights book, so I became very hardcore vegetarian in the prison. So I refused to have any meat, and they thought I was going on a hunger strike, but I had to explain to them, I tried to explain to them that I was doing it for philosophical reasons, but obviously even human rights are not so well developed in Egypt, and especially not animal rights, so it was difficult to convey to them the message that I was not eating animal meats because of philosophical reasons. So I used to eat fish once a week as well, just to avoid any more questions and also to keep my weight up because they were very worried that I was losing too much weight. So the food, I usually had a rotation of 4 different foods.
So you ended up being detained for almost 5 months.
Correct. 5 months, and by the fourth month, for the first 3 months, I didn't know anything. By the last month, I started receiving information and signs of and positive signs that there may be a resolution and a way out. So that was pretty much by the last month I started seeing the light at the end of the tunnel.
So you started to receive information.
My condition started to improve, and some of the officers started hinting at me that I may be able to be released if I play my cards right, and also by this point I still was not actually officially charged in trial. So that was also a positive sign that if they hadn't charged me yet, I mean they were unsure about how they were going to proceed with the situation. Most people knew if I were ever charged and I was taken into their judiciary system, then my situation would be a lot more difficult to resolve diplomatically. So they were trying to keep my case outside of the judiciary as long as possible. They were able to hold me up to 6 months without officially charging me. So I was already at 4 months, and then I started to think that they have to make a decision. And I was told that there was that they were trying to reach an agreement with. Somehow, I didn't know, at the time I didn't know who was negotiating what, but I just knew that there was a lot of action, diplomatic action going on.
So then, what happened as far as you know?
So then, in about the last month, for the first time I was taken to a place that I was never taken, and that usually I was only taken back and forth to the prosecutor's office and once in a while to the courtroom. But now they took me to another room within the complex where I was being held. And then there I met two Israelis, and it was the first time I actually met Israelis since the first week, I met the embassy the first week, but and then I haven't heard from them since. This is the first time I met Israeli negotiators, and I said that they were negotiators. One of them was Yisrael Chasson from the Knesset, and then a lawyer for one of the prime minister's lawyers, Yitzhak Malko. And then they were both waiting in a room, and all of a sudden I was in a room without the prosecutor. And they told me that they were here trying to negotiate a resolution, and they wanted to see how I was doing. And they just wanted to make sure that that I was healthy. And they also wanted to get my spirits up, get a picture with me, which I thought was a very unusual request given the circumstances. So I thought that was like a good sign. And then they said that, and they reassured me that they think that there'll be an end to this. They thought there would be an end to this within at most a few weeks, if not a few days. And then that was how they left me at that time. So it was really only a 6 or 7 minute conversation, but it was new, and it was new information, which was very helpful. So it gave me some hope.
So what was the next thing you heard?
So then I was cut off again. Then I was taken back to my room, and I was cut off from more information. And then, which I thought was a bad sign, I worried that maybe there was some sort of diplomatic, diplomatic problems between Israel and Egypt, which have happened over the past, which could always happen. You never know what will happen in the region. But apparently I was being just cut off from information about the deal that was, what was going on. They didn't want me to read about anything related to my deal. So they kept, they pretty much cut off all the newspapers for me at that point. And then a few days later, they called me down. They asked me, oh, what do I want to eat for my last meal? And then I took pizza. And then I said, oh, the last meal before what? And I said, don't worry about that. You'll see shortly. So I thought, well, at least I'm going to be taken to another room after 4.5 months of seeing the same four walls. And then I had my pizza. They put me into the van where I was first taken in, which I was first taken in. And then we drove off, but now they were a little bit more festive. And then they took off my blindfold halfway through the ride, which was a positive sign. And then we kept on driving for about another hour. And then the guys that were holding me put on ski masks, which I thought was a bad sign, because I am not used to seeing people put on ski masks out of the blue. And then they opened the door. They said goodbye with their ski masks on, and then they pretty much pushed me out, threw out my bag, and then the van drove off. And then I found myself surrounded by a bunch of Egyptian special forces officers who were guarding the area. And then right next to us was an airplane, was a private airplane. And from the airplane came down the two Israelis from the meeting from a few days ago. These were the Knesset member and the lawyer. And then they said, good to see you again. They gave me a newspaper from Israel where they had the picture that we took from a few days ago. And in the paper, I was able to read for the first time that I was going home, that Ilan Gopal was going home. And they said it was an exchange for 25 Egyptian drug dealers, and that we were being released early. And then there was going to be this prisoner swap, and I was going to go home. And so that was how I discovered that I was actually leaving.
Let me remind our listeners, this is the Logic Consortium here on 88.7 WLUW, and we're speaking with Ilan Grappel, who's taking us through his story in 2011, how he was detained by Egyptian officials, accused of espionage, and then his release was negotiated in exchange for 25, we were just heard, Egyptian drug dealers. And so, Ilan, you're on the tarmac there, so you get onto the plane. And then what happens?
It took about 25 minutes before the negotiators finished finishing up the deal and talking on the phone and doing whatever they had to do to finish up the last minute arrangements. And then we go on the plane, the door closes, and once we take off, we are able to take a sigh of relief. And they explained to me how close everything was going from blowing up, that the situation could have went either way. And that now that we're actually off Egyptian soil, now we can actually breathe easy for the first time in 4.5 months. And then we flew back to Israel. The 25 Egyptians crossed the border were greeted by their family members, where they were able to return back to their hashish trade if they so wish. I'm an honored guest now in the Sinai Desert, amongst the various Bedouin tribes. And then I flew back where I landed, and then I met all the dignitaries. I thanked, I said all my thank yous. And then eventually I went back to law school and met you on the phone through the radio.
So, I mean, coming back to the U.S., you met all the dignitaries, and then you came back to the U.S. as, I mean, how did it feel? I mean, how were you received? Tell us about how it was.
The first day was obviously a bit of a shock because I didn't know what was going on, and I still had to be, my congressman, Congressman Ackerman, he came from New York to meet me, so I was under his wing for the first day. I met the Prime Minister. He gave me a hamburger despite my vegetarian tendencies or my vegetarian principles, but he also gave me whiskey, so that was good enough. The first day was obviously very hectic, and I had to make a lot of statements. I spoke to a lot of people. And then within 24 hours, we had to fly back to the United States. The congressman arranged us to have a flight. It was weird to go on the plane, and then everybody's going on the plane with me, and then on the plane they give out the newspapers, and then I was on the newspaper, so people are trying to understand what's going on before they realize exactly what the connection was, and they read the article, and they come up to, like, shake my hand. So it was that, and then I get back to the United States to JFK. I make a few more statements. I apologize to President Obama. I hope he had no hard feelings regarding any signs that I held. And then it was a good 2 months, and then I went back to life again. I went back to law school. I had a few interviews. I had a lot of people that were interested in their story. I had this dream that I would go to South America, which I couldn't do because I had to go back to law school. So instead, I went to Miami, where I get to go to the Cuban neighborhood, Cayocho, for a few days of just being outside of just to have a vacation from everything that went on. And then I went back to law school, which is not exactly a vacation, but it was back to real life.
So you, I mean, obviously, you conducted a lot of interviews when you came back to the States.
I tried to do one. I tried to do like one official interview in Hebrew for the Israeli press. I did one in the print media, one in the for the television. I did one for CNN, and I made a few more statements. Also, in the first few months, I wasn't really. I didn't know what I wanted to say yet. But I just wanted to get something out. They were very pressuring. The media was very pressuring to have a statement at the time. So I made a few hasty statements, and then I'm back to school. And then eventually, I started to also speak in a lot of different arena. And then I got used to it more. This is my first radio interview, which is more strange for me. But I'm more used to speaking actually to people in person, which I did a number of those. And I still, once in a while, if I'm always there's people that are interested in the region, so I still am able to speak about it. And I'm still interested in the region, so I'm also able to at least converse about the topic.
And looking back on it, what do you think happened, or what are your comments about the region, or the things that you think were at play?
In the region, I feel that it's always there's always a tension between what the people in the street think, and by the region I mean the Arab world. There was a tension between placating the public opinion, the street opinion, and also maintaining the authoritarian governing body, whoever it may be at the time. So there's always this tension, and then in my case, they probably thought they could use me as a tool to build up their credibility with the people, and also find a scapegoat for any problems that were going on. However, they weren't particularly savvy in making their accusations, or knowing how to trump up charges. So a lot of the charges seem to be completely ludicrous, and even in Egyptian eyes, and the Egyptians would leave many conspiracy theories regarding Israel, but And some of these, at least with regards to me, they took a bit too far, probably, for most people to believe. Which was to my favor, because then they realized that if they weren't even convincing some of all of their people, and they were also taking heat from the United States, then they had less of an interest in keeping me or maintaining the story. So they searched for another way out. And then they still, even when they released me, they did it in a way where they never actually exonerated me or expressed any regret, but they said that they were releasing me in order to release their noble Egyptian citizens who were locked up in Israeli jails. And this is a way for them to do a public service to release these Egyptians who, in reality, they didn't have any particular affinity for a bunch of drug dealers, but they just needed to somehow gain some sort of public credibility. So that's, I mean, in both ends, both when they arrested and both when they released me, they were looking for a way to gain credibility in the public eyes.
Ilan, do people still remember your story now? I mean, like, a few...
They remember it hazily. They know there was a story from 3 years ago. They might, if they do Wikipedia, they might look at my Wikipedia page, and then they might refresh their memory. Obviously, the picture that they had when I first got out was different than I look now 3 years later. And also, it's not that easy to... it's never that easy to recognize somebody on the street if you've only seen them a few times on two-dimensional television screen. So now, once in a while, if they see the name, they may remember if they follow the region very closely, they also may remember it more. They may remember the story, but the normal person would probably be less inclined to remember.
And when you speak to people, is there a message you want people to take away?
I mean, when I speak, it depends on the situation. I mean, I just try to convey, one, why I would go there. That whenever we travel, there's often risk. Some are situations are more risky than others. I wouldn't advocate going to risky places for taking pictures. But sometimes there's overriding benefits, overriding utility that might justify the risk. And in this case, I think that refugee rights and asylum rights, particularly in that region where there are very egregious violations and the needs of these populations are very serious and very imminent. That they have very imminent needs to find a place for resettlement. But there is good to be done with these communities, even in risky situations, that it's always going to be a cost-benefit analysis when we're making these risks about deciding where to travel in the world, such as with regards to my personal situation.
Well, Ilan Grappel, thank you so much for coming on today's show. We really appreciate speaking with you and you sharing your story with us.
Thank you. Pleasure talking to you. And hopefully we'll speak again sometime, and maybe in real life.
Yes, hopefully, and thank you so much for your time. We really appreciate it. Have a great night.
Thank you, Ilan. Bye. See you in Israel.
Bye. See you in Iran.
And that was our interview with Ilan Grappel. Thanks so much. We'll be back in 2 weeks. This is the Logic Consortium.